The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hello and welcome to Wednesday. It's all downhill from here. Of course, here it's been downhill for a while. So we're glad you're joining us. Hey, don't forget, before we get to the show today, we're on tour. We're going to see you soon in a city near you. Just go to glenbeck.com/tour.
See all the cities, pick up the tickets there, and it's going to be a really fun time, especially, you know, given to how close it is to the election. It always provides extra commentary.
And really, it's the 2020 election. I mean, this election is really important, but like Beto, which we talked about in the podcast today, he's not running for senator of Texas. He's running for president. That's why he's
vice president.
He's running for something big because they're desperate. Who else do they have?
Well, Joe Biden. Joe Biden.
And again, in the podcast today, Bill O'Reilly. Hillary Clinton. He thinks Hillary Clinton's going to run.
Yeah, Bill's on today because he's not on. We had to move the days around a little bit for some scheduling stuff. So Bill's normal Friday slot happens today. Goes through a lot of stuff. But yeah, he was fairly convinced that he thinks Hillary's going to try to run again. And that case behind it is interesting. I don't know if I'm on board with that theory. I mean, she definitely wants to.
Right.
I think that's all she wants.
And the crazy story about, I don't even know what fake news is anymore. Because you're like, oh, hey, did you hear Saudi Arabia cut a guy up and he was alive while they dismembered him? You know, they're in the embassy. You'd be like, come on. No, that's real news. Can't tell the difference between fake news and real news now. The story gets even more bizarre with Saudi Arabia. Also, Beto and Cruz on today's podcast.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program. It's Wednesday, October 17th. Glenn Beck.
Let me bring you up to speed in case you don't know. The story started a couple of weeks ago with this idea that this Washington Post reporter is suddenly missing. Well, he's not a Washington Post reporter only. His name is Jamal Khashoggi, and he is a Saudi Arabian citizen. He is also a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. His beef with Saudi Arabia in his own what he called self-imposed exile is all about the Saudis not befriending and not excusing the behavior of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Saudis are very clear that the Muslim Brotherhood is a terrorist organization and not a friend to Saudi Arabia or really anyone in the world. So he went into self-imposed exile and he came here to the United States. There are claims that he was still a Muslim Brotherhood operative. There are also claims that he was feeding us information against the Muslim Brotherhood. I'm not sure which to believe at this point. So he's overseas. He's in Turkey. And he is going to get married, but he's been divorced to his wife in Saudi Arabia. For him to be able to get remarried, he has to have a divorce certificate from Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Arabians say, well, you're going to have to come into the embassy to get it. Now, he is not a friend to the Saudi Arabian prince, the one who has been this big reformer, and he's going to, you know, take Saudi Arabia into the future, and he's good for women, and he's good for human rights and everything else. Khashoggi is not popular with that prince, and that prince has not been popular with Khashoggi. He had been trying to get Khashoggi to come back to Saudi Arabia, but Khashoggi knew that would probably be a death sentence to me. He takes his fiance, they get into a car, and they drive up to the embassy, the Saudi embassy in Istanbul. He says, I'm going to go in, I'm going to get the paperwork, they're expecting me, I'll be right back out, wait for me. So she did. Hours pass. She starts to call the embassy. She calls his phone. No answer. Nothing. As it turns out, Saudi Arabia first denied that any of this happened. But we now know that they are about to admit. We don't know to what extent. But it looks as though he was interrogated, tortured, and killed. He was then hacked into pieces and thrown onto a Saudi plane in suitcases. And what happened from there, we don't know. Now, there's an additional update today. We have our Secretary of State over in Saudi Arabia meeting with the king and the crown prince, who are now saying privately that, yes, this was just somebody who went rogue. But it's kind of hard to believe. The new information today, now this is coming from Turkey, so we don't know if this is true or not. There were two stories. One, the United States came out pretty quickly last week when this story broke and said, we have evidence that this was ordered by Saudi Arabia and he is dead. But they never released where that came from. They just released that this was U.S. intelligence sources say. That was the first nick. Then the Turks came out and said that they had audio and videotape of this man's interrogation, torture, and killing. I don't know if they do. There is a possibility that they have microwave technology that could listen if the Saudi embassy was not prepared to deal with that kind of surveillance. You can get that kind of audio from inside of a building. But there's also another story that this actually audio arrived first with his fiance, because he had an Apple Watch. And when he went in, he turned it on and it recorded. And when it finished recording, it just uploaded to the cloud and downloaded to her phone. I hope to God that's not true for her sake. I can't imagine, especially since we now are getting the story that this audio that we don't know yet if it exists includes his interrogation and then the executioners come in. And the head of the embassy said, you can't kill him. You can't kill him in here or I'm going to get into trouble. And the what's described as the pathologist from Saudi Arabia, the guy who was in charge of killing and disposing of the body, apparently said to the head of the embassy, if you want to live, you need to get out of here right now. Otherwise, you're next. They knocked Khashoggi unconscious, and he was unconscious for a while. Then you hear them apparently starting to get all of the tools and everything ready and the room ready to start to chop him up. He is still alive when they are dismembering him, and apparently it is a gruesome, gruesome tape. We again don't know if that is true. This may be an Archduke Ferdinand moment down the road. This may be the thing that sets the world on fire that doesn't seem like the thing that could set the world on fire. But Saudi Arabia is our ally. We are currently fighting the war on terror with Saudi Arabia. We're currently fighting a proxy war with Saudi Arabia in Yemen. We are getting ready to sell billions of dollars worth of war machinery to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is quietly supportive of Israel now in the Middle East and are taking strong stands to support Israel. They are also an ally with us against Iran. They are a balance of power. If this tape exists, and this tape comes out, we have all known that Saudi Arabia is a bad place, but we have not heard the screams. If this tape exists and comes out, people of the world will forever think of Saudi Arabia and put them in the same class as Stalin, as Hitler, as Mao, or as Kim Jong-un in North Korea. But we remember North Korea's crimes we only have sketches of. If this tape exists and comes out, it's a game changer that could destabilize everything. This is the best of the Glenn Beck program. A new poll finds that among entertainers, which is an interesting word for this, the most divisive celebrities in America, the number one, I don't think you'd ever guess, number two was Sean Hannity. Number three, Rush Limbaugh. I don't put them in the entertainers role, but then Ellen, LeBron James.
Ellen is a divisive. I mean,
I know.
That
I know.
Seems like not a divisive character.
Jay-Z, Katy Perry, Lady Gaga, Rihanna, and George Clooney.
What?
Yeah.
That's a weird list.
Well, who's number one? Beyonce.
That's really weird. Is that based on her Super Bowl performance?
I don't even know.
Or she sort of celebrated the Black Panthers? Is that
maybe? I mean, haven't we got over that yet? Yeah, I mean, we've had a lot of other things that we've had to worry about since then.
Interestingly, missing from that list, which you would have once always been on, is a Glenn Beck.
Yeah. Well, I'm not in that world anymore.
Right. I do think people have united in dislike for Glenn. I think that's something that's happened.
Wait, hold on.
I know it's happened in this world, but I mean, yes. I think it's happened across America.
Wait a minute. Welcome to the program, Mr. Pat Gray, who now does mornings on the Blaze Radio Network. Mm-hmm. And Steve Dace is doing the show immediately following this one. Steve is on loan from CRTV. And we're pleased to have him. He's really, really good and really smart. And Pat, of course, is, I think, the best morning man in America. So don't miss him.
Only saying that because it's true. So
I was actually being humble. I was counting myself out this particular time because that's the kind of guy I am. So humble.
Generous. Anyway. Thank you.
So, Pat, welcome to the program. Did you watch Cruz and Beto last night?
Yeah, wasn't that? It was fun.
Riveting.
It was riveting and fun. I think they're really going after each other. I think these two guys genuinely dislike each other, and I know I dislike one of them a great deal.
Gee, I wonder which one.
Can you guess?
Yeah, well, you're Irish.
It starts in B and ends in Edo.
Interestingly, you don't seem to like the one who is the white dude, and you like the Hispanic.
Isn't that interesting?
Race, which is not consistent with
your... Fascinating. Did you notice, too, that his name is actually going to appear as just Beto, well, Beto O'Rourke, on the ballot?
But that's,
it's not going to be Robert Francis Beto. It is unbelievable.
Well, no, wait a minute. Neither is Ted.
I know, but please. What is Raphael?
Yes. You know, it's funny.
I think that with the quotes, it's an easy way to do it, right? Like Raphael, quote Ted Cruz is fine.
Yeah. Yes.
Beto is a nickname, though.
It is a nickname. I don't buy that it's been his since he was five.
Maybe.
Did anybody buy that?
Maybe. He's from El Paso. Maybe.
When it was a teenager, he got that nickname, no?
Well, when he appeared on, and we play this audio all the time on Pat Gray Unleashed, but when he appeared on the El Paso TV morning show back in, I think it was 92 or 93, and he was with his punk rock band, they called him Bob. They called him Bob there. So I don't know that it was even, he even had it then, because the host didn't refer to him that way at all, and he didn't correct him. So I don't know.
What's interesting is Ted changed or used the name Ted to be more, I guess, American, if you will. Mm-hmm. Also, I think to separate himself from his father, Raphael. Mm-hmm. But that came really early.
Yeah,
and here's an Irish guy changes
trying
his name.
Trying to identify as Hispanic.
Yeah, trying to be more Hispanic. It's crazy.
He also went so far as back in 2012, he tried to join the Hispanic caucus in the Congress. And they said no.
He did not.
He did. Yeah, he tried to get into the Hispanic caucus. Because some of the El Paso residents, his district is 77% Hispanic. So some of the residents were upset that Sylvester Reyes was no longer going to be in the pretty powerful Hispanic caucus. So he tried to join it. They're like, no, the nickname's not enough. Sorry.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, if we go to the intersectionality of Beto, nobody's intersecting him.
No.
Nobody's intersecting him. No. He is still at the top of the hierarchy and the patriarchy pyramid.
I have to think one of my favorite parts of the debate last night was when Beto tried to make this case that every decision Ted Cruz makes is about money. So, like, he supports the Second Amendment, and that's because of the NRA, and he supports this cause. And it's like, you've brought in $38 million of donations.
Right.
You are outraising Cruz by, what, 4-1, 5-1? And, of course, as Cruz pointed out, he's had plenty of special interest money come in. It's just coming in through other names. It's coming in through PACs that he, quote-unquote, doesn't control, which we all know how that game goes. I mean, the idea that you're going to come out and make an argument about how Ted Cruz is about money when the entire story arc of Beto is based on the fact that he can raise money well. He's not competitive in this race. He has never accomplished anything.
Now. Yeah.
He is only in the race to run for 2020.
But if he loses, how does he run for 2020?
I don't know, but they're still talking about him.
They are.
Even De Niro was talking about him.
He's their John F. Kennedy.
He's the great Democrat hope right now.
And may I say, the great white hope.
Yeah. 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 It's been fascinating to watch this. He also tried to pin Ted up against Donald Trump, since they have the big rally coming up, what is it, next Wednesday or Thursday in Houston, and by calling him Lion Ted, like Trump did. And he said that's why the president called him Lion Ted, and it's why his nickname stuck, because it's true.
Ugh.
Which has never...
It's never stuck, and it's never true.
It's never stuck. It's never been true. And what prompted him to say that about Beto was that he had voted for a bill that would raise the price of oil 24 cents a gallon, to put a $10 surcharge on every barrel of oil, which would raise the price about 24 cents.
The price of gas.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So Beto said that was untrue, but he voted against a bill that would have stopped that bill. So it really is true that he did. But they can both kind of claim that they have the truth on their side in that particular case. But it was interesting to me because CNN fact-checked Beto on some things that he's been lying about during the campaign, one being that his mother's a lifelong Republican.
I love this.
Lifelong Republican.
Right.
But now, you know, because he's so wonderful and he's so uniting,
yeah,
she's going to vote for him.
For the first time.
For the first time.
She's a life.
That is something. First of all, your mom is going to vote for you? Wow. That's what a revelation.
Wow.
You got your mom to vote for you?
Right. And help me out, Pat, because I think CNN even looked into this one.
They sure did.
Yeah. And
yeah,
they
find? He voted for a hardcore Republican named Barack Obama in 2008.
Right. Oh, Barry Obama?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Here, Barry.
God, Barry. Yeah.
Okay, so here's the interesting thing. I love this part of the expose from CNN. And she can't remember who she voted for in 2016.
Wait, you remember 10 years ago, but not two. Weird.
Really? You don't know who you voted for.
Yeah, you know, she voted for Hillary and just didn't want to say it. Didn't want to say it.
She couldn't. If she voted for Trump, it would work to his advantage.
Yeah.
She was there. She was part of the Trump thing.
Yeah.
You know, she wanted change. She wanted this. It would have worked.
Right.
So,
but you can't use that.
She voted for Obama
in 08,
this lifelong Republican, and then she can't remember in 16.
The other interesting aspect is that this lifelong Republican has voted in every single Democratic primary in Texas since 2000.
That's awesome.
And even went so far as donating money to the Obama campaign in 07.
I love this the Federalist on this too. I know a lot about Beto. But at the same time, I don't know much about Senate candidate Josh Hawley, who is 38 years old, meaning, you know, around 8 years younger than rising star Beto, the attorney general of Missouri and the Republican nominee for the U.S. Senate. What I do know is that Hawley is slightly leading McCaskill, a two-time incumbent in the average poll, in a race that could decide which party controls the Senate. O'Rourke, who's up against Ted Cruz, an incumbent, is down 7 points and falling. It wouldn't be completely surprising if Cruz ends up winning Texas by nearly the same margin he did in 2012. As with Hawley, I didn't know much about Arizona's GOP Senate nominee, Martha McSally, either. I'm probably not alone. She didn't get to kibitz with Stephen Colbert or Ellen DeGeneres. Maybe if she used a nickname she was given to her as a teen, she would have a better luck getting attention from the national media. Anyway, what could one of the highest-ranking female pilots in the history of the Air Force and first woman pilot on a combat mission possibly have to offer to Colbert's audience?
Oh, my gosh. Get her on the air.
Awesome,
I want
right?
to talk to her on the air.
I mean, after all, Beto did skateboard through a Whataburger parking
yes.
lot. McSally, by the way, also has a chance to win. I think she's going to win in Arizona. I think she has a really good chance. That's another really tight race. I would also bring up John James into this conversation. We've talked to him before. He's a Senate candidate with a great military background
oh, yeah.
in Michigan.
Yeah.
He's got a much tougher race, but he's another great story. These guys get no attention, but Beto, because I don't know, he's I guess a good looking guy, and he's, you know,
he's got neck muscles.
He's got neck yeah. muscles. He's very shiny. As you may have noticed in the debate, I mean, it's real. He's almost like his
Something
face has a mirror
shiny.
Painted onto it. It was so shiny.
He's
last
new and
night.
Shiny.
He's new and shiny. And I guess that's
look,
what we want.
Look at the shiny thing. Look at the shiny thing.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hi, it's Glenn. If you're a subscriber to the podcast, can you do us a favor and rate us on iTunes? If you're not a subscriber, become one today and listen on your own time. You can subscribe on iTunes. Thanks. Bill O'Reilly joins us today. He's not going to be with us on Friday. Bill, I don't know why the left is trying to make a hero now out of Monica Lewinsky. Monica Lewinsky, let her get on with her life for the love of Pete. The one that really needs to be reexamined is Juanita Broderick.
Well, it's not going to happen. I mean, it's a bigger picture. First of all, Beck, I'm addicted to outrage like you are. I'm just addicted to outrage.
Yes, I know.
The bigger picture here is this. The Democratic Party is confused now. They don't know what to do, all right? Juanita Broderick claimed that Bill Clinton tried to rape her. The press never in a million years is going to give that allegation any exposure at all, none. It's not going to happen. So you could talk about it, I could talk about whatever.
She had much more. I mean, she was credible. She was
okay,
credible.
But it's just not going to happen. They're not going to get back into it. And they didn't report it when it happened.
Okay, so but why are they then getting into the Monica Lewinsky thing?
Because they have to at least acknowledge that Hillary Clinton, beyond all rationality, is putting herself out there in these positions where she has to relitigate this stuff. Now, the reason she's doing it is she wants to remain relevant so she can run again for president. No, I'm serious.
Come on, really? You
know, Beck,
do you really
you,
think...
you know that I'm the most brilliant political analyst in the country.
No, I don't know.
I am telling you that she wants to run again for president in 2020.
No, I know she wants to run. Do
yes.
you really think she will?
It depends. Depends a lot on Biden. It depends a lot on whether she feels that the field against her is weak, which it is absolutely weak. But the bigger picture is that the Democratic Party doesn't know what to do with Bill and Hillary Clinton. They don't know what to do with them. All right. So Bill Clinton and Hillary are going on a road and talk to their devoted supporters. This isn't an accident. This is a trial. I mean, to see how many people show up, how enthusiastic they are. Bill will say, look, when I was president, we did all this, and Hillary was a great first lady, and she did all this, and then she was a great senator, and she was a great secretary of state. That's what this is. It's ginning it up across the country to see how it's going to fly. But if you think Hillary Clinton is just going to go away quietly into the night, she's not. She wants to be president. And she realizes that the Democratic field, as it stands now, is extremely weak. Who's going to vote for Elizabeth Warren? I mean, that Native
not the
American
Cherokee people.
Thing, no, that no. crushed her.
Yeah, it's horrible.
It crushed her. The Boston Globe thought it was doing her a favor by saying, "Oh yeah, we she got a little bit of blood in there." But and then the Cherokee Nation, the Cherokees themselves came out and said, "Knock it off, will you? She's not Cherokee. This is a total ruse and fraud. Knock it off." The Cherokee Indians themselves.
It's crazy.
Okay? And Warren used that ruse, as I say in my message of the day on BillO'Reilly.com today, used the ruse to advance her career in academia. So, and this is a woman who thinks she's going to win an election? She's not. Only in Massachusetts and maybe in Oregon, you know, these states that she could get into the Senate. But as a national viable candidate, no way.
Bill, so, as the nation's number one political strategist, do you? Because how could she come out with this whole thing, Elizabeth Warren, without having someone on record from the Cherokee Nation to support her? I mean, how did she not see
does.
This coming?
She has her grandmother who once told her when she was three that she had high cheekbones, and that's because way, 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 way back. She was a Cherokee.
It just
so
doesn't.
Her grandmother, you know, was a source of all of this. But look, getting back to Beck's Hillary Clinton scenario, Hillary Clinton is a woman who is obsessed.
Oh, yeah.
All right? She doesn't fit into the Me Too movement. Uh-huh. Obviously, she doesn't fit in there because she has her husband. And she doesn't fit into the far left, even though she panders to them all the time, because
she's corrupt.
Basically,
she's the system.
Yeah, she's a system, a pal, what they call in New York. She's a pal. So, but she and her husband, and I spent, I was at the Yankee game, and I talked to Bill Clinton for about 20 minutes, as I mentioned to you last time I was on. She and her husband say, you know what? They may not like us, they being the Democratic voters, but we're so much better than what is up there now. I mean, Michael Bloomberg is going to run for president on a Democratic ticket. And, you know, outside of New York, nobody knows who Bloomberg is. Very smart guy, by the way. Extremely intelligent. All right. But he doesn't really have much of a chance, but he's got a lot of dough. He's got a lot of money, and he'll be in there. But other than that, you tell me, if Biden doesn't go, and Biden, I think, is going to be 98 years old next year. I don't know. He's an older senior citizen.
I will tell you this, Bill. You know who I think is positioning for a run? And I don't think in 2020, but I think 2024. I don't think it's going to be Hillary Clinton that will be the first lady that becomes president. I think it could be Michelle Obama.
Maybe. I'm not sure whether Michelle Obama has the drive, but certainly she would be formidable, and then there's Barack, and it's the reverse, you know. Mm-hmm. But they don't have the resume. I mean, the Obamas, if you don't like them, I mean, they conducted themselves pretty well personally.
I'm not sure you need
the
I'm not sure you need the resume. I mean, I heard The Rock say, you know, if I'm going to seriously do this, I've got to actually run something. I can't just be in movies. And I thought to myself, I'm not sure that matters.
It doesn't matter anymore. Trump has smashed that, but it's certainly a plus for Michelle Obama because she doesn't have any little attachments. and so that, you know, that's not going to be a diversion. So you might be right there. I mean, I don't know her that well. I met her a few times. I know she was very powerful in the White House,
mm-hmm.
extremely powerful, mm-hmm. and that was kept very quiet.
And
you
I
might
think
be right. You might, you know, this isn't her time. The next time around, she don't want to go up against Trump. Certainly doesn't want to do that. But in 2024, absolutely, she could, if she wanted it. I think the Democratic Party would rally around her.
Yeah. I'll play some audio for you from Portland. This is a woman who is standing waiting to cross the street. She is a widow of a New York police officer who lost his life on 9/11. And Antifa is standing behind, and they are just, well, listen, here it is.
Why are you trying to block me? I'm trying to walk here.
I obey traffic signals.
You're a snarky little idiot. Shut the up.
Try something.
I'm not going to punch you. I'm not like your husband. I'm not going to punch you.
I'm not
like your boyfriend or your top boyfriend who's going to knock you out, so don't worry.
My husband died in 9/11.
Good for him. Good. Good. Those NYPD were a bunch of sodomizing immigrants with their bully sticks. So yeah, you're a Your husband probably should rot in the grave.
Bill?
Yeah. Look, the good news is there aren't many of these people. It's not like Germany where the SA and Antifa are the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same people. The SA were Hitler's street thugs who went out and beat up anybody who opposed Nazism and all that. And they were they had little uniforms, little brown shirts. They ran around, and the authorities did the same thing they're doing in Portland, Oregon. They stepped back and let these SA bully boys beat up innocent people and insult mm-hmm. them like that. Exactly the same.
Yeah.
No difference.
This happens.
I want everybody to get that.
Yeah, this happens. I mean, it happened with the black shirts as well in Italy. This is...
Yeah, Mussolini's guy.
And that's what they do.
That's the blueprint.
Right.
Okay, so here's the story. I used to work in Portland, Oregon. I worked at Channel 2 there. And beautiful place, beautiful state. But Multnomah County, where Portland is located, is a far-left hippie place. And it has been that for many, many years, where they are permissive. They want the farthest left politicians they can get, and they have it. So now you got a guy, Wheeler, the mayor of the town, who runs a police bureau, that's what they call it there, who basically says, I'm not going to enforce the law, not going to do it, and that poor woman is going to be assaulted verbally and not allowed to walk where she wants. And that's okay with me, Mayor Ted Wheeler. That's fine. And I'm going to tell my officers, don't help that woman. Don't interfere there. And also, I'm going to let Antifa surround the ICE headquarters, and I'm going to let them do pretty much whatever they want to do, including fighting on the street, using masks over their faces, carrying weapons. They can do whatever they want to do. Now, this is America. You would think the people of Portland, Oregon would rise up, right? That they would go out in the Rose City with signs condemning the mayor and Antifa and mass, tens of thousands of them. They gather by the Willamette River with the signs, this is not the city we want. Do you got anybody out there doing that?
Mm-mm.
Nobody. So this is the problem. The problem is not Wheeler. The problem is not Antifa. The problem is the people in Portland, Oregon. And that's why I wrote Killing the SS, because I'm saying we better wake up here in America. We better wake up and confront evil, and Antifa is evil.
So,
did I get my point across, guys?
I think you did, and I've got a lot to ask you about on this. But let me start with this. Why do you suppose that there isn't an uprising in Portland? Are they Are they blind to it for some reason? Or do they actually support it? Are they afraid to come out? What's the real reason?
Leadership in Multnomah County. So you, if I were still working in Channel 2, I'd be doing commentaries going, okay, I'm going to be out on the banks of the Willamette River. I'm going to be there at 10 in the morning on a Saturday. I want you all come out and support what I'm doing. Okay, nobody's going to do that. There's nobody in town going to do that with any visibility at all. Number two, unfortunately, because there are many, many, many good people in Portland and Multnomah County, and I have friends there, most people are selfish. All right? They're into their own pursuits. They're doing whatever they want to do. And you know what? This is an annoyance, but, yeah, I don't really want to spend time on this. And then maybe they're not like me. And maybe Antifa will hit me, or I'm not going to do it. It's a selfish thing. And it's not just in Portland, Oregon. I mean, we have to really, as a people, we really have to start to rise up and say, hey, you know what? We want due process. We want a presumption of innocence. We don't want thugs on the streets in masks beating people up and telling women that their husband should rot in a grave. We don't want that. Okay, so in Portland, do we have any Democratic? Because it's all Democrats, 100%. Got any politicians there? Got the governor of Oregon doing anything about this? Saying anything about it? No. No, no, no. Uh-uh. And that's how far we've come. That's how far we've declined.
This is the Best of the Glenn Beck Program.
So we have Ephraim Matos in with us, and Ephraim was with us a couple months ago, I think. And he has put out a new book called City of Death, Humanitarian Warriors in the Battle of Mosul.
Yes.
Welcome. Glad you're here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back on.
You bet. So tell me a little bit about the battle and recap where we've been together before with this book. So tell the story.
Okay, so last time I was on, we talked about the book, and we talked about the Nazarene Fund. So the book is about a journey I basically went on last year, a humanitarian work I did in northern Iraq to help with the fight against ISIS. So as a former SEAL, it was a natural fit for me to go and help. Now, I originally thought I was just going to be doing, you know, the standard humanitarian thing of handing out water bottles, doing a little bit of medical aid. Well, when I got in there, the team I was with, a group called the Free Burma Rangers, we ended up embedding with the Iraqi army and basically becoming their frontline medical support because they just don't have the resources to do that themselves. And so I was not a medic. I was a sniper. But I had pretty good medical training from my time as a SEAL. And so we actually ended up being involved in the direct assault into Mosul to open up the Western Front in Mosul and finally collapse the caliphate in Mosul. And we were in the city for about 30 days. From the day that we entered the city to the day that I ended up getting shot on a rescue mission, it was exactly 30 days. And what happened in Mosul was just, it was something I thought I would never see in my lifetime. You see evil, you see pictures of World War II, you see killing fields, you see these black and white photos, and you think, I'll never see something like that. You know, there's a certain amount of denial that you have. Well, I saw it, and it was real. And so in City of Death, I talk about my experience of going in there and sort of being caught off guard with the amount of violence and the fighting that was happening. But more importantly, the acts of heroism on the side of the Iraqi army and of the other guys I was with. It was amazing. To see these guys laying down their lives for others.
Give us an example of you know, that black and white film and then the heroism around it.
So, yeah, you look at old World War II photos, right? You got these mm-hmm. black and white pictures of killing fields. Well, on June 2nd of last year, it was early morning, and we saw a fresh killing field. We were literally at the very, very front edge of the Iraqi army advance, and we looked out into this what had used to have been a six-lane highway through the city. It was completely rubbled and mortar holes, and it was mm-hmm. completely rubbled. But we started seeing bodies. We started seeing bodies of dead kids, elderly people. There was a man in a wheelchair slumped over. He'd been executed. And we started seeing dozens and dozens of bodies. And so in City of Death, I talk about how we got up there, we saw what was happening, but it, as bad as it was, we saw people still alive in the bodies. There were children walking around in unwounded, and they were in shock, and they'd been out there for about 36 hours at this point. And their dead relatives are everywhere, and they're going around from body to body trying to find water, anybody. Trying to find food. And so we saw four kids alive and two wounded men slumped up against a wall in a pile of about 20 bodies. The most grotesque, terrible thing you can imagine.
Why did they do this? Why were all these people executed at the end?
These people were executed because they were leaving the caliphate. These were people who had endured more than likely the full 3 years of the ISIS occupation in Mosul, and they were done. They wanted to leave. They wanted to get out of there because as the noose was tightening around the neck of ISIS, you know, supplies and food and water were becoming more and more scarce. And so ISIS was stealing all that from the civilians. And so living behind the ISIS wall in Mosul was absolute hell for these people. So they tried to break free and run away. And so when these people ran away as a large group, ISIS massacred. I think that day there was more than 150 people just slaughtered in the street because they went right by the ISIS headquarters.
How did the ISIS people, I've heard that they've kind of gone back in. They've just kind of morphed back into a lot of society. Is that true?
We did come across a lot of guys trying to blend in with society and kind of get out of there. And that has happened. So ISIS is definitely having a bit of a resurgence in Iraq right now. So they went underground, you know, and it was neighbors and just people who've all lived together, right? So these guys blend in. They're from the city of Mosul, ISIS. That's where these guys are from. And so they were able to blend back into society, a lot of them. And so now we're seeing a bit of a resurgence. However, the guys that we were seeing toward the end of the fight in Mosul, a lot of these guys were actually white European guys, a lot of Chechens and things like that. Mm. And the reason for that is because they have no choice but to fight and die. They can't assimilate back into society. They can't run away because they look like me. They're white guys, red beards, mm-hmm. and they can't get away. So those guys had to fight it out all the way to the end, and they know they're going to die, and they just didn't care. And so, yeah.
So you went from that to saying, I've got to keep doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And that brought you to Burma,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
And now you're working with the Nazarene Fund.
Yes.
In Burma.
Yes.
And last we talked, you were the only one in Burma, and you started telling us about what was really happening.
Mm-hmm.
And you have an update for us.
Yes, absolutely. So also to clarify, I'm not the only one working in Burma. I'm the only one from the Nazarene Fund working in Burma.
Yeah. You were telling me that you were trying to organize a bunch of people.
Yes.
And you were going to bring them all together.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I just got back from a trip about a week and a half ago, and I met with a lot of the tribal leaders and the guys who run stuff across the border. And they are beyond ecstatic to have the Nazarene Fund's help.
Okay, now this is a group of Christians?
Yes, about 50% Christian, about 50% Buddhist.
Okay.
All the leaders of it's called the Karen tribe, and they are, all of their leaders, about 90% of their leaders are Christian. So every time I meet with them, we pray at the beginning and at the end, and it's a really, really good thing. And so I met with these guys, and I explained to them like what we can do, and I'd already been working in there. I'd already done several trips with the Nazarene Fund in there. And they are beyond ecstatic to have us because when I was there, literally while I was there, the Burma army just moved in 350 more troops to attack their positions, to attack the civilians in Karen State. So we just saw what happened last year with the Rohingya. And then the Burma army moved all of those same troops up to the north to attack the Kachin, another ethnic group. And so now they're starting to bring troops down to attack the Karen. And that's where we're there on the ground helping keep people alive.
So why are they doing this? Why are they doing this to these tribes?
It's an ethnic thing. It's a racist thing is essentially what it is. It goes back 1,000 years of the ethnic Burmans who control the Irrawaddy Valley, sort of in the center of Burma. They want to control all the highlands. They want to control the entire region. And so if you're a different ethnicity, you can, they'll let you live there, but you have to be sort of a subject, serf class. You have to basically serve the Burmans, and also for example, the Karen, they live in the hills, and the Karen hills are full of natural resources. So there's a lot of that going on. Plus they don't like you because you're Christian, right? That adds, that just adds a whole nother level of hatred. Because, you know, Christians don't put up with being oppressed. They don't put up with it because where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty, right? And these, and so because of that, the Burma army attacks them even more.
Tell me what you brought me.
So I brought with me several photos.
One second. Do we have somebody, or is Marissa just passed there?
I apologize.
That's
thank
okay.
you. So I brought with me several photos of what I see all the time when I go to these places. And these are, I brought with me photos, sorry, of one particular attack that happened. This is actually only from, this is from 2010, right? So it seems like a long time ago, but this is, these are the only photos that they were able to get out to me. I was asking these guys, I was like, hey, I need photos of what's happening and what's going on. And in these photos, you see dead civilians, you see kids dead, a baby, and these are not accidental collateral damage. These are intentional executions of these people.
These are, some of these are kids.
That's a baby.
Baby.
That's a baby. Intentionally killed. And that baby didn't die right away. It survived for about 24 hours and then died.
And this just looks like it's in the woods.
Yeah, they're out in the jungle. These people have nothing, and the Burma army still wants to attack them and take more from them. And so every time I go there, every time the Nazarene Fund shows up, we're stopping that from happening. And I'll tell you a quick story. Back in May, I was there, and I can't divulge exactly what we were for security operations, exactly what was happening. Suffice it to say, we saved a lot of people's lives. And a villager who had been pushed out of his home by the Burma army, him and his family had fled the Burma army, and they built a new hut out in the jungle in the middle of nowhere. He heard that the Nazarene Fund was there, and he came and found me, and he said, "Hey, I wanna thank you. Please come to my house for dinner tonight." So they get me on a motorcycle, and I drive to this man's house in the middle of nowhere. When I get in there, his wife is cooking pig fat for me to eat because they have pig fat and rice and bamboo leaves. And so we're sitting there, and he's like, "Hey, I wish I had more to give you." He's like, "This is all I have for a snack." And he pulls out a bag, and it's literally tree bark. It's bark from a tree. And he's like, "This is all we have to snack on while my wife prepares food." And he gave me tree bark to eat. And I'm sitting there chewing on tree bark with this guy, and he has nothing. He has literally nothing. And he wanted to give me tree bark because that was the best that he had. And so I'm sitting there chewing on tree bark with this man. And I was so overcome. I was just like, his gratitude, the level of gratitude he showed for us, for the Nazarene Fund being there, it was unbelievable. It was so touching. And then later on, as I was leaving the jungle, another man barely speaks any English. I'm on a motorcycle, and he's driving me out of the jungle. And as he's driving, he turns to me, and he says, "Thank you." And I said, "Oh, good English. What?" I'm trying to pimp him and talk more about, about what use more English. And so I was like, "Oh, like what are you grateful for? What, you know?"
Yeah.
And he said, "This is amazing." He said, "Thank you for giving my people hope." That's what he says to me. This kid who's maybe 19 years old, they know nothing but slaughter and massacre and these terrible things, but we're there to bring hope and we're there to bring help. And it's an honor to be there. It's an honor to represent the Nazarene Fund. It's an honor to do what I do. Every time we go out, we save people's lives, and it's an incredible thing. And we keep things like those photos that you're looking at. You can't even show them. We keep that. We keep things like that from happening.
Torn on. It doesn't become real to people until they see it, and then you don't want to show it because it's awful. It's awful. It's horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what to do with them.
I think I'm not sure, but I think we have them on the NazareneFund.org. If people want to go over there and see firsthand, like what's happening, I believe they're up there. If they're not, I'll make sure that they get on there today. They're over there.
Yeah, don't go for you know, if you mean, it's their children and a baby, and it's not pretty. But if you if it will help you wake up to what's happening, if it will help you wake someone else up, then please go. But we would sure appreciate your help. The Nazarene mm-hmm. Fund has turned into this global thing that is just remarkable. Mm-hmm. And countries all around the world now know its name as a beacon of hope. And
indeed,
we are thrilled
yes.
that you're part of it. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for letting me be a part of it. It's yeah. It's an incredible honor to do what I do.
Your book is well worth the read. If you want to know and be put into it, but put into it for a good reason. I mean, here's a guy who, you know, was a Navy SEAL and says, I can do more. It's called The City of Death, and it's available everywhere now. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Glenn.
God bless.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.